honor him as one who is no longer writing for us. But I think he's left a lot to think about. So now, in these today and tomorrow, give special honor and attention to his words in particular. And I hope everybody can read this, even if you haven't read Meaning of Persons. The Woman of Andros is so short and very easy to read. In case anybody doesn't want to get in it over their heads, it won't get you in over your heads as far as the language used, but the thinking there, you might find yourself over your head once in a while. Today you might remember that I'm really going to put the hour in your hands, in your mouths, in your hearts, minds, however you respond, maybe guts, John's favorite word. Anyway, get some gut responses out here. I thought I have plenty that I could say and keep on and on about probably, and I'm going to try not to do that unless it becomes helpful for some reason. But as I also mentioned last time, I've read this book now every year, and I think it's almost a temptation for me to try to retell the book instead of, and it's in order for it to become your book. I mean, that's fine, that's my book then. But this is today at least, and hopefully tomorrow too, we'll all be sharing the book as a group and from our individual responses, so I don't want to dominate it that much, but I think even those of you who haven't read it will get a good taste of what's involved in reading it and what ideas and concerns are considered vital to Tournier. And I might add that just the few things that I've read and heard since Friday, most of them have had some direct application for me to what I was reading and thinking about with Meaning of Persons. And I think that that's true for any book that you read when you take it seriously into yourself, which is also something we talked about Friday. And I hope that any reading you do here, whether it's in relation to the Lifestyles program or your own interests, that you'll be having that sort of a response, that the things that you read will go into you and make a kind of sticky center, flypaper type thing, where other ideas and thoughts and images will have a place to stick for a while and become a part of you too. And anyway, that's my hope and certainly a great deal of my expectation for the continuing discussion now of Meaning of Persons. I'd like to add to our common hearing part of a letter, just a quick one we got today from Kent Smith, who was on Lifestyle last year, and he's at Luther College this year. And something he happened to bring up, and to me, maybe this is my personal sticky paper and it won't be yours, we'll find out, but I'd like to put it into the context of Meaning in Persons, and you don't have to respond to it at all or at once or anything, but I think you might be interested too. In Religion, we have been reading some of Bonhoeffer's letters. He is so exciting and has such good things to say. I have a hard time understanding his idea of religionless Christianity, but I like the idea that the reality of the world and the reality of God are the same thing. He is so right that we are going to suffer in this world if we follow Christ, and that we are not to have or seek a spiritual existence. Lately, I have been coming in contact with some people who speak in tongues and have been baptized in the Spirit. They say that only if you speak in tongues, then you have perfect prayer. They make you feel like a heathen if you don't go to their prayer meetings and sing their, I think it's L-Y-E songs, on Friday and Saturday night. But I can't do that. I know that they aren't right because it's always a spiritual high. But how do you counteract something like that? That's not living in the reality of the world, as Bonhoeffer defines it, is it? This all seems to come to who you accept as your authority or authorities, Bonhoeffer or Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth. And anyway, and he gives it, this is good too for Meaning of Persons. In English, we just finished reading Ambiguous Adventure by Sheik Kane, an African author. It tells about Samba, the main character, going from a strictly oral culture into the middle of a written culture. He goes from the land of Dilobi, where he was at one with everyone in nature, and where death was a friend. To Paris, where people separate themselves from the earth by wearing shoes, where they have no bodies because of all the clothes they wear. The levels of interpretation are numerous and excellent book. Anyway, you can put that into your files. And I think at least that last paragraph in relationship to personages might be a fairly obvious illustration for you. But at least that's... Maybe you want a cartoon now or later. I had to run back and get this. Lucy was looking at it, but I forgot. She likes the cartoons too. That's where we get it for. I'm going to pass this around. I'll read it to you first. You can see this all. Help. I'm trapped in an executive vice president. Just for your... Don't go leaping through it, Yolanda. I'm sure you'll be distracted. There are lots of them right around there. But anyway, lots of things that seem quite separate can come together while you're thinking about a particular thing or exposing yourself to particular disciplines. Okay. I have one thing I wanted to carry over from the last discussion, sort of where we ended, in which I think that just about anything we talk about today would come under, and that is that the truth shall make us free indeed. And that's Christ's promise of himself to us. And then the fact that truth does not oppose itself. You get worried about, well, what if I found out more about this and more about that, and then no longer will whatever I thought before be true. And there's a phrase somebody gave me, and I feel it has been a real gift for me, but I can't remember who said it. The idea that, probably it was John, since he's the person I most often talk to, but the idea that any truth that you have at any given time is not something that you have to defend, because another truth, another part of truth, if it comes and it's too big for that package of truth that you're holding, you'll have a bigger thing instead. It won't be less. Mm-hmm. And we do have to fear the kinds of rigid lines we draw around what we decide is true. But that's part of growing too. And so, anyway, we're free indeed, and we're being made free indeed anyway, and being adventurers in life instead of explainers of it. So, when you're thinking about now what you'd like to bring into our common reference as a group and sharing some things that might feel stupid or awkward or not quite thought out to the extent you'd like to before you open your mouth about them or whatever, I just like to give you this encouragement that and at this point, I think a messy discussion is a lot more fruitful than a tight one. I don't think we're really pursuing what he's talking about if each of us were going to make a thesis statement and cover ourselves well in terms of the rational history for it. So, even if you don't think it will fit, or if you're not sure if you really agree with what you're going to say or whatever, I'd really like to encourage making mistakes today, if that's what it feels like. I doubt if there'll be mistakes. It's very hard in this kind of pursuit to make mistakes. It isn't like you have a right answer at the end. In fact, that's one thing about the way Trinity writes that I think is especially interesting from somebody who's an authority in experience of this sort. You don't have the feeling when you start that he's really got all the answers and he's waiting for the end to tell, he's just working you up into a certain pitch so that you're ready for the end. He's coming with us in this, and we're sharing a path of pursuit and facing some unknowns that he also faces, and he's not calculating a response from us or trying to manipulate us in that particular way so that we agree with him at the end of the book, At least I don't feel he is, and it, maybe you will. That's even possible. You may even disagree with me. I don't know. That, I'm not going to say too much more because I don't encourage that. I think everyone should agree with me. So much more pleasant. Much more agreeable. No. Actually, it's a lot more fun if you don't always disagree, or if you don't always agree. So take each other on, or me on, or whatever. And I hope that you'll be able to respond to each other, too. I'm not, although I probably have read as much Tierney, or maybe more than most of you here, that doesn't mean that I'm the one to give the answers. You know, or if you have a response, or you're requesting a response, look around the room too. Don't just look at me. I'm the only one here who thinks and feels, and you know, we're all human. Amazing. Here we are. Okay. Tierney has identified himself with Socrates in this tape that the village has, and I just heard it over the weekend. And he uses the term midwife, which was Socrates' favorite explanation of his work, what he did. He didn't call himself a philosopher. He was trying to bring people through into real life, into truth. And Tierney says that's also his concern. And I think it's the concern of most teachers, preachers, any of us. When we're on our knees and when we're not full of our personages, at any rate, because he identifies himself as a midwife, I saw a couple images for traps in our seeing ourselves as persons, and one of them was a kind of a conscious rationalization, which I would call an abortion of ourselves. We decide rationally that we are not, we don't need it, we're not prepared for it, we can't take the consequences, etc. And another one is more of a miscarriage, where it's an unconscious thing, but we don't at that point have the opportunity physically able at that point to handle this. Well, maybe we're not always able to take on our birth process, and that the whole point is that what we are in is a life of hope, and there is never that this is the end. You can go, you know, you've had it. There's no more chance for you.
I'm curious about those analogies. I like them, and I want you to kind of state them again so I can kind of write them down. But I don't quite understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, I haven't thought. It's just an image, and I haven't worked it through to an analogy. You can work it out if you think it's worth it. But it's just that there are temptations or traps for us not becoming persons. Otherwise, why would this be interesting, you know, the pursuit of our personhood? The possibility is there that we will refuse it, or that we won't be able to become persons to the extent of a rebirth. You see, and that's all. I don't want to push it any farther than that, because I take an abortion more as a conscious thing, and a miscarriage as an unconscious thing, and that both those are possible. I mean, we can choose not to accept something, or for various reasons we may not be able to at certain points accept this birth or this coming person of ourselves. And because the connection, the thing that kind of sparked that was Socrates and his midwife status in terms of truth, and that Tierney also sees that relationship.
Are you saying that we have this birth potential at every minute of our life, every single minute? Maybe it's the personage or another part of ourselves that would put that down. Physically, we can't handle a birth every single minute.
Mm-hmm.
But is it?
Well, if you take that analogy back farther, there's conception, and it takes a while. I don't know how hard it can ride on that kind of an image. But anyway, I think that the hope, I guess, is the big circle that I'd like to keep it in, and that because we're talking in terms of Christ and what he can do with our lives, basically, and this is underlying everything in Turnagain, there is not a point of no return. We don't... We've never cut ourselves off completely. That doesn't mean that we're always pregnant with this. But I think that other people too. You don't have to worry about cutting through my neat little picture because I haven't really put that much of myself into it yet. So, see where it falls short and bring in other things too. But I know that he's really emphasized in almost every chapter here and the different ways he's looking at problems of being a person and describing what kind of world we live in and how life, what kind of life is possible to us, that part of the description is that we deal with death all the time and rebirth, and that you don't have this single conversion sort of experience or a single moment of rebirth, but that it's very much biblical again in New Testament and in the dailiness of our need. We can't store up grace, he says, and I think in Guilt and Grace, that we're given grace drop by drop, in the sense that it's sufficient unto the day, and we don't have a grace bank. And so even to the extent of the positive, what we think of as the positive new life that's available to us, we can't get our hands on it and get this kind of security for being alive. We can't get a living security built up. That's Christ.
What did you mean by death?
Well, anybody got some underlinings or notes from some of the sections on his analogy with the biological life and how we're dependent on death in that sense, living with it all the time.
On page 97, it says, life is creation, life is death. Life is at one, in the same time, both creation and death. Creation in its inner unseen existence, death in its visible manifestation.
I think I've got the wrong book. I don't have pages that are gonna.
It's almost at the end of that chapter.
Third page from
the end. The biology chapter.
Is that also right? Is there fairly close to the example that all we can measure of life is the death of life?
Yeah.
Meaning.
All we see of life is death. Of it is its death.
How did that example, that chapter, things that's dealing with, could somebody kind of explain it briefly for anybody who hasn't read that far or hasn't gotten? Randy, maybe since you're in, I know you've got that, so you could do that. Just remember the image of the conductor and the orchestra too, the composer. He's a scientist. Turing is a
medical doctor and a psychologist.
Yeah, and identified very much with the scientific community or the methods of science, and I think he does an admirable job of keeping the two from being at war with each other. The sort of human perspectives, the lay person's way of looking at things, and then the scientific way, or whatever you want to call it, different methods.
I have something else underlined here. It says, the fabric of our existence is woven from end to end with these automatisms. Physiological psychological, moral, and spiritual as well. They serve to give a certain continuity to our being. Quote some doctor, and he says that difficult to distinguish consciousness from the automatism it has created. So they're really there. One isn't above the other one. They both work together.
I think that's one of the hardest things in talking about this book is when you get into talking about persons and personages.
Yeah, they both work together.
Yeah, you want to say one thing, you describe one, and it seems to put the other thing out of context, or that it shouldn't, a negative association somehow with personage then, and death. I mean, really, how much closer can you get to negative than calling something death? That's pretty a negative statement. But what Randy just read was part of his example of our living, our continuity, even the cells. I think that's one of the illustrations that are dead maintain us, you know, in a sense. You have both the shape of our lives or the shape of our persons revealed in automatic or mechanical kinds of ways. And I think maybe part of the difficulty or the danger is having that reversed too much, although that's also natural and part of how we live, is having the automatic or mechanical sides of us or images. I think the United States being the super ad machine country, probably, advertising running so much of our lives without even our knowing, I mean, unconsciously, that too much of our image of ourselves feeding back into who our person is. Now this gets tricky to talk like this, because right away I want to say yes, but that also happens, and that's all right too. I mean, that's normal and healthy. And what it's mostly pointing me to right now is that a real dangerous thing in talking about this or anything is to simplify it. And maybe that's why it takes Turnier a fairly long book to talk about something that seems rather simple to describe. This is the issue. How do we become ourselves, our person? What's in the way? Okay. Basically, that's the first half of the book. Now, how do we get there? And the second half of the book, how come it takes so many pages? and the problem of keeping us in going in a particular direction without simplifying the issues is really complex. And that paradoxical description is about the state of affairs we're in talking about it. This thing of death and personages and life and the person and the image of that I was thinking of is one of the, it talks about this orchestra. Life is not a river. Life is an orchestra. No, life is an orchestra. And you have the conductor and the composer working on the orchestra and trying to get this piece. The composer, in his analogy, is God, who has our real music, our real selves in mind, and our person is the conductor trying to pull it out of the orchestra, which is a conglomeration of personages, maybe. Now, he doesn't bring it down so specifically, and probably it's a much better metaphor or analogy if it doesn't have such a specific description, but just for our ability to talk about it, if all of you haven't read it, that's kind of the way he uses science and his... the way science has looked at the world, which is a kind of reduction of reality as he looks at the world, because it's looking at death and calling it life in most cases. And the scientists that he quotes, where they're talking about the unknown, what the only, I wrote down one thing, I don't know. Well, he's got scuff days. He's got so many that life directs living phenomena. It's not a causal relationship to it. That is, it doesn't happen because our bodies are here, therefore we live. And that's pretty simplistic, but anyway, it's that it's something pulling life out of us, ahead of us, see? This thing of, we're directed out there instead of back there. We don't figure ourselves out by going backwards or reading our death signs, quote. Maybe in relation to this, what did you think of his conclusions or his statements about introspection, self-examination, psychoanalysis? In various spots, he has quite interesting comments, I think, on those things, especially from his area. You know, that's what he's involved with, basically. You don't have to have direct quotes if you can recall
that's,
anything.
That's about where I am in the book. And when you first said freedom, the truth shall make us free indeed, that's the first thing that came to my mind, how striking that is to me that the freedom of being taken out of that introspection and yet what's there is okay. You know, it's there and acceptable, but it's almost like I don't have to chop it up and be on guard of being out of and keeping out of that, you know, and being so chopped up in my life that like I'm drawn out and away from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really like it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and anybody else in that part? That
the statement he makes that introspection actually alters the person. I just put a big exclamation mark by that because that was a whole new thing. It kind of adds to that.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly looking inside yourself. It alters what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. The whole process that explains that.
There isn't this sort of objective reality that you can just sort of turn it in, the beam in on yourself and say, this is it. That you're also affecting yourself. I think that's good to think of in terms of the whole thing, that you're never outside of your living being, a living world. You can't make that kind of distance on your life or anyone else's. You can say, in your best interest, I'm going to, and in all honesty, I'm going to tell you I just think that your habits are, well, bastardly or, you know, unlivable or whatever. And you may find that you can make these little trick statements to yourself and think you've somehow removed yourself from the situation enough not to be affected, but that's not true. You affect other people and you are affected. And no less in the dialogues you have with yourself and the kinds of things you do in the interest of honesty with yourself or in the interest of growth or whatever. There isn't that kind of an objective beam that you can throw on anything. At least I don't think so, according to Turnier.
That's about the strongest feeling I've gotten so far, which is only like about 40 pages, but the number of times he has admitted his own inability to do that in a relationship, causing a sort of a breakdown, or maybe an honesty with more than what he was talking about, to see himself and his own personage involved in blocking out the personhood of himself. There's no black and white. I mean, I think that's probably the most unsettling thing.
He says something about, talk about unsettling and no black and white. He says that about sanity and healthiness. He says one thing we can comfort that those who have had a mental illness, we can comfort them with the fact that there is no such thing as stability, and those people who are stable are actually not very well. So, that helps, doesn't it? No, but that the whole underlying theme of of how we can become ourselves or humans or find our personhood or whatever the terms are, becomes one of forgiveness. And the forgiveness establishment of man only makes sense if you need to be forgiven for something. And the only way to see that is to have a certain amount of truth about yourself, about the world, before you. And in face of that truth, you're usually knocked down pretty flat. And that's a sign of weakness in this world, to be down. You're supposed to be up. And so this whole thing, like I mentioned before, the inversion, he calls the inversion of truth, which the gospel presents, you know, it really is an upside-down world according to any secular, and I'm making that distinction just, you know, I much prefer that, like what Kent wrote about Bonhoeffer, the whole world is God's, and to make those religious or sacred and secular distinctions is kind of arbitrary and not maybe so helpful, but I think you know what I mean. That world, the worldly, the fleshly, maybe that's what I should call it. That's certainly from Paul, way of looking at life and what's a good life and what's a important goal-oriented life, what shows strength and strength mostly means, you know, that you're worth something, right? I mean, I'm worth your respect, or you better at least listen to me, you know, and I got to prove it. And he brings that up in relation to the professions which are very dependent on what people think of you, which his is one of them. He says that. Now, it's great. I'm not going to read through the whole thing because it takes me so long to find those things, but if you think of when he's talking about showing this weakness to whoever he's talking to, a patient is in, and how shocked they are if the first thing he does is say, I know exactly that situation. In my own life I had this such and such an experience, and they go, I came here for help. You know, I'm paying you. and he said, now what, you know, there is a real tension there. What do you do? It's like I'm a mother. What am I supposed to do? Lucy does something, am I supposed to say, I know exactly how you feel, Lucy, and that's terrible, and it's terribly upsetting to have somebody keep telling you to eat your supper when you don't want to eat. And I'm also responsible for her in a certain way. She's supposed to eat to stay healthy, to stay alive, etc. Well, in a sense, you see, like the doctor, you've got to be able to hear something that he says in order for his work to do you any good, so-called. That's usually what we think, or a teacher. And yet, Tournier says that the most important moments in our lives are moments of shared weakness. But on the other hand, that paradox, there is no such thing as calculated shared weakness. So,
on that same thing about understanding and shared with me something this morning on page 17 at the bottom, that is, it is precisely because objective scientific disciplines are involved that we are able to form a picture. Talks about forming a picture and seeing an organized whole. But it goes on later in that paragraph on the top of the next page to say, it is a study, an explanation, an interpretation, not an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's like total personage.
It's an externalized, yeah. He mentioned something like, related to that in this tape, when he talked about person, it was very personal. Those of you who have heard it already know, I just almost a testimonial sort of his life and what's happened and how he came into the situation he's been in and when he's writing books and at that point of speaking. But he talks about these three levels of persons and life, I think. And the first one is an intellectual one. In other words, where we can exchange information, but it's not communication. Steve, are you in meditation?
know something, right? She's a bouncer.
Two bouncers on either side.
No.
Here for airplanes.
No.
Anyway, that the first one is an intellectual one. And it's not to put any of them down, you see. I mean, it's vital that we have an intellectual exchange. We have to be able to understand each other. We have to have some common ground of exchange, the marketplace, whether it's ideas or economics or emotionally in relationships. There's a common, some common area that you don't have to go through the depths and the heights of life to talk to somebody, to ask them for the peas, you know. And then the second one is a kind of a, it's called, well, I don't think that's, do you, now catch me on it. If you think I'm going, you know, I may exaggerate myself out of truth in this situation, and I certainly want you to catch me on it if you can. But I know. But the second level he talked about was an emotional one, where that's somehow more significant when you are in a relationship which you've shared less. It's less of an exchange of information, and yet it's not the closest intimacy that is available to us as humans. And then the third one is the spiritual one. And he's definitely not aligned with people who divide us up in terms of mind or body or soul and body or anything like that. And here we get caught in language, and he mentions even language as being a part of our personages, where it's hard, language molds us too. And we have to be careful, and we have to be aware that some things just aren't big enough. They can't say it very well. You need two mouths almost to say something. One thing says this, and the other says this right away. And that's a great thing about dialogue, is that you have someone, you know, I can't say everything at once. You hear it, and you can respond with something that needs to be said. And it doesn't mean that we're in disagreement or that we both can't agree on it, but I can't say it all. Anyway.
I like the end of the dialogue chapter 2 when he talks about the secret. Mm-hmm. Even if you can't say anything, you know, not to say it all, to keep some things that you should expose all of you. That's what I got. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that it's not wrong, that you're not an open,
yeah.
You know, that somehow to be healthy is to be wide open, vulnerable, all times, you know. I think that's really a possible misinterpretation of anybody who talks about freedom, that in terms of being a person, that means I am totally accessible equally to all of you. Like that thing you were talking about, Terry, that equality story that or movie that Vonnegut's. You know, that we're not equally in relationship to each other. It's impossible. The one place where that happens, and it hardly fits the terms, would be in the Christian church when we're confessing our sins. That's the only thing I can think of, just, you know, without any researching. But I can't think of any other place where I would dare say we were in, and that is only because we're relating at that moment to God first and seeing our state. And
that's where he says that. And that's the only place people meet, the persons meet, only meet in the conviction of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and just run it through your mind for a minute. You know, anytime you're not convinced, you know, you might feel like you're convicted of your own sin, convinced of your own sin. But if you don't, if you're relating to somebody and you don't think they have that conviction of sin, you've got a personage up there just like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're mm-hmm. You know, there's no chance. You just shuffle through your various, parts and put something forward that you feel that the other will,
mm-hmm.
accept.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how quick that response is. You figure out what style that an individual appreciates, and in time you develop all these masks
or defenses almost in that relationship. You know, thinking of the Bible study yesterday morning really hit me, where when you're put on the defensive, or you feel that you have, you know, you're threatened and defensive. When you're in Christ, you can say, it's true. What you say is true. And I just thought, my goodness, that whole sense of relief that how I see myself or how somebody else sees me is not what's the vital issue. That's not the most important thing. And in that sense too, then, the truth really frees us. The truth that Christ has for us, which is the only one that can operate in any culture, time that I see, anyway. It's not bound up. It can lead the way out of prisons of our own making, of other people's making, of a culture, of whatever. Even to the point of such a personal relationship as a marriage, where you are, when you're in conflict in a marriage, even between those two people, where the most intimacy that we're allowed probably as humans is possible to us, and when that's broken, it feels terrible. And even there, Christ frees us. I mean, there all these inside outside freedoms that are given. And it doesn't mean that at every moment we make them available, you know, to us.
Praise us. And how does that come back to what John said about talking to someone who would not be in the conviction of sin? And in the conviction of sin is where you'd be able to open up and say something to him, whereas the other person, you would just be talking to him in a different way. I don't understand that.
I don't know if I understand for sure that...
I didn't quite understand what John said.
I wasn't saying that was a good state of affairs to come up with a dead personage. It's not like that new one in the Stage of Journey who talks about the, you know, sorry, every breakthrough then becomes a personage, you know, mm-hmm. and then you break through and so forth. But we have different, there are different styles or different personages that are really like these stiff Greek masks, but if we're dealing with somebody who doesn't, is, we feel is not convinced and convicted of their own sin, we will tend to put on those masks and pick the one that they, you know, that is not repugnant to them. But that isn't a good state of affairs. I don't think it certainly isn't something that we have to, you know, we try to develop. I think indeed that a person that could do it best would be probably a great used car salesman, a real great one, or somebody selling ice boxes to Eskimos, you know. But it's not something that we want. And I think, did your question were you responding to?
I guess I don't quite understand the difference in responding to someone that is. I mean, just knowing that the person is under conviction of sin, how that would
release that kind of a
image. Both are meeting in grace, really. I mean, that you know, both know that you don't have if the other is convicted of sin, you don't have to feel like there's going to be fault finding going on. If somebody's going to look to see you do something dumb, you know, for one. And that you can feel free to meet in grace, knowing that you both need it. And sometimes you can establish the... You can... there are things that you can do that can convince others that you are convicted of sin. You know that you're that kind of person. And then I think then you could help the other person meet himself. You know, meet his real self.
Yeah, but
make sense?
Yeah, but so there's a, in knowing that there's a sort of trust and
some sort of connection there between the communication between the two people, of some sort of trust set up or type relationship?
Trust is a part of it. I think, make it a major thing.
Yeah, I think that you have to think back to some of the examples in the book where Attorney talks about this sort of thing happening. That's tremendous communion between two people, and as he's experienced it. And I can't think of any time, I'm sure he doesn't see it, and I can't think of any time where he uses an illustration where there was great intimacy, where he doesn't call it a gift, and definitely God's grace, God's presence between these two people. It isn't, I don't think you could even say that trust, you know, I ultimately trust you, and so I dare show my weakness. That isn't true.
I think you have to trust God first.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the trust.
That's the only, yeah, and in fact, that's probably the only thing you actually trust. And then because you can trust God, you can sin boldly, which doesn't mean, you know, that you, I can't give you any, then after that you will do this, this, and this. But I think that is a real, that's the elemental foundation. It's like the first commandment. I mean, we don't talk a lot about the commandments. Luther does, I guess, from what I hear from Luther, as he's read around here. But I don't hear, and we aren't in a conversation very often about the commandments. And yet, look at that, that first commandment is really something. That's like, sets the world straight. Who do we put before God? My relationships, or my jobs, or my reputation, or whatever. I mean, there are all kinds of things. Idolatry is that one of the biggest temptations. That's why it's probably the first commandment. But myself. Maybe it's even the discovery of my own self that becomes more important than God, in the sense that it becomes the most important thing in my life. And isn't it, God doesn't want us to have all those things. I mean, my goodness, that's, Christ says, the abundant life, you know, overflowing. It's not something that we're going to be in a smaller place because we find what forgiveness or weakness means before God. It's to get us out of these small places that we have worked up in our heads. And psychology as a tool, as a gift, can help this process, you know. And it's not something that's, although like Tournier says, the worst, he's criticized by both theologians and psychologists for mixing the fields. And he says that, he doesn't think that's the worst thing that can happen. He thinks the worst thing that can happen, it is very normal to mix them, but to do it without knowing you're doing it is really frightening and frightful. And he just gives a few illustrations of some of the people that he's treated who have had that experience with a psychologist or a psychiatrist, where they've given them ultimately philosophical advice or reins to hold, where they didn't tell their patient that this is what they were doing. It was part of the treatment.
It's like Gaius and
the ambition of man.
You know, the student thought that he was going to get an English lesson of that bad philosophy instead.
Yeah, so it's not only psychology, obviously.
Robert Cole's article about that, too.
But anyway, this thing, you know, you get... I don't know if your tendency is like mine, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were similarities. Is it hot? Is anybody else hot in here? I just, okay. Well, if I just don't want to encourage my own sleepy head, but anyway, my tendency tends to be that when I see something, I want to go after that thing and make that the point. See, like, okay, I see this is really important. Seeing my weakness, that's what's important. Somehow I've got to get to the point where I can recognize my weakness, and then I'll have something made that I didn't have made before. And you see the kind of a tricky state of affairs I'm already in, even though something's really come through to me. weakness. Acknowledge it. The freedom of it. My goodness, you know, it really can knock you over. To be relieved of images that plague you or tempt you or keep you in bondage. No matter how lovely and attractive the images might be, they're binding you up. Be free of those and admitting that that isn't me. And yet, what's the point? See, there's an idolatry lane or something, at least as I see it, right there. And that is vital. It is, definitely, that's true. That's one part of the truth in this book. And I don't know. What
about that? Just a bibliography, you know, another book, a book by Viktor Frankl,
mm-hmm.
The Doctor and the Soul.
Mm.
It goes a lot into how the doctor has to know that he may be slipping in a little philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
It's about distinguishing, how the doctor can distinguish between dealing with the problem and injecting his own personal things. The whole book's on that.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure it is an area that's terrifically significant for anybody in those fields once if they're concerned for this truth. But it wouldn't necessarily be significant if there wasn't, you know, if they didn't have that concern. They didn't see that this was a real danger. They wouldn't recognize. Most of us don't recognize our sloughs of whatever, the clutters in the corner that we've learned to live with or whatever. They take somebody else or a brighter light or something to see that. And Trini and Frankl, for various reasons, have seen that, you know, like in this area of psychology, that's something they have to be aware of. But there are things just like that that I have to be aware of, and I'm a mother, maybe, see, or a teacher, or businessman, woman, or, you know, whatever. That's not the only field where this sort of thing is dangerous or happens. And isn't that part of the personage, too? Because, I don't know, you can get a real taste for certain things. It's fun to have people listen to me for a change. I like this, you know?
Mm-hmm. That is an easy reference.
It's Lucy and Sam who don't listen to me, right? No. But you know, I could be really, that's what I can say it sort of facetiously to check me on what I say, but I might really just get, you know, kind of taken up with the fun of being able to explore some ideas on my own. I tend to think more or more specifically or more imaginatively often in a dialogue kind of situation. So here I am. You know, this great opportunity to think through things myself. Well, some things are important for everybody and some things aren't, and you're part of that checking. But I don't know, you've got a responsibility right from the moment you're born. You're the brother or sister or the caretaker of someone or something. And this finding out who we are and what the world is like and what it's all for, those aren't just empty questions. I think that Karen, is it Karen Quinlan?
Mm-hmm.
Case is something that obviously it's not the only thing of its kind in our country, but that's the legally publicized situation. Well, what comes before you get to that point? There is a real philosophic question, real ethical question. Before that, there's a metaphysical or a theological question. What's it for? You know, when does life start and death end? We start making, could we say, well, she's no longer a person, according to Trinier, or she still could be a person, so we'll make that the criterion. And I don't want to get into a discussion of that issue, except that these things have repercussions and implications. There you go, Scott. Implications. You wanted me to bring that out. Way beyond our own interesting, you know. That's all right. I got you. Implications beyond our, you know, interest in sharing an idea for a while. And I don't know how to get how to make those things important to you or to anyone besides myself. I don't always know how to keep it important to me. But what about the idea of the shadow? He uses Jung's image of the shadow, and is that the phrase from Jung too, or is that you or a father or somebody?
He uses it.
Shaking hands with your shadow. Anyway, we're talking about weakness. Weakness is fine. If we don't get too descriptive, I can handle that term. Sure, I'll admit my weakness. Now, if all of a sudden weakness is my dirty clothes or my garbage sitting in front of you, I'm not about to start, unloading that right here. And yet, weakness as a term is useful in discussion, and we'll use that, Okay, what really is happening in something that's admitting your weakness or confessing your weakness? And why is it that ultimately the point is before God? Who are we? And to see our weakness there.
Melissa, one thing just in beginning the book that really struck me, because when we first started talking about, one thing that really hit home was the vanity of a handwriting when after you got his PhD. And I can remember specifically practicing fancy handwriting when I was younger, But all along to that, I thought, well, that's not really me. I mean, I really don't have too many of those things. I mean, I have this, and I work on that. But it's so tied up in my daily life that I really don't see very clearly. And that's what Turnier kept saying over to me. Seek first the Lord, and then this kind of light started illuminating things. And I was just, afterwards I thought, wow, I stand at the bottom, as a servant, condemned, and yet I'm still accepted for that. But with not the illusions that I generally carry around about, good days and quote-unquote doing good. It was really good. It was just some good fresh air again. Mm-hmm. Because when things start going so well, it's pretty soon, well, I'm doing all of this, And really, the context that I have that, how honest are they? I was really thinking that through this afternoon. I'm not sorry if it doesn't give any more questions out.
I don't think
should lead on to things, but
I think it's just hard to respond sometimes when you get an immediate response, something that's personal. It's like I said, it's not just saying weakness. Karen's talking about Karen. And ultimately things happen only at that point where Trini is talking about me, Elise. And I have to put myself in it and not, I wish so-and-so would read this book. Mm-hmm. Sure would be good for, a typical sermon response. Boy, I wish somebody could accept something.
What Karen just said was what abolition was not for me. I just felt like she'd been there or something.
Mm-hmm. I think she probably has too. I think that thing, when he talks about introspection in here and self-examination, I think it's pretty clear that in itself it simply to get into this whole area or even to say things isn't enough. To get it out isn't enough. It's part of it, but it isn't enough. And that introspection has a kind of attraction, a fascination that you get in. Even if it's black, horrible stuff that you start running into, it still can keep grabbing you. And the difference between being shown your sin, your state, the state that you are in, or state that I am in as a human, simply by being born, plus the fact that I am me, myself, Elise, born, is that I'm given...
We're sorry, but the rest of this tape was not recorded.